taking a good strong coffee and are ready for the afternoon session. We're going to be talking about trends in international ship finance. And I've got a panel here, Nicholas, Berlin, Christopher and Christian. I'll ask each of them to give an introduction to themselves and also their organisation shortly. But before I do that, I just wanted to kind of cover the themes that we're going to touch upon today. The first theme is capital providers. We're now operating in a market where there is a large selection of capital providers. You've got your more traditional European banks, Chinese leasing, JOLCO arrangers, Korean finance providers. You've got funds, Asian banks, and increasingly out of the Middle East, the Middle Eastern banks are coming into the shipping space to provide capital. Next theme or trend that we're going to touch upon is products and structures. Over the last decade, I personally have seen an evolution in terms of the structures that are available in ship finance. 10 years ago, predominantly mortgage-backed financing, but now a big part of what we all do is leasing structures as well. Chinese leasing, JOLCO structures, we've got project finance structures on the kind of LNG side of things, and increasingly I'm seeing hybrid structures, so debt and equity coming in. The third theme we'll talk about is interest rate environment, and we'll link that to asset values as well, and we'll look at how that interplays with LTV ratios. The fifth theme is vessel life optimization and retrofits. There we'll look at the availability of finance and some sort of the practical and legal challenges around that. The last thing we'll discuss are JVs, M&A activity and funds, and what this means from a financing perspective. So I'm just going to move down the panel now, starting with you, Nicholas, and then everyone else. Brief introduction to yourself, but also your organization, and then perhaps just to give some flavor, the type of clients that you work with, the deal sizes, the asset class.
Sure. Thank you very much, Jeffrey. So my name is Nicholas Duran. I'm a managing director at the investment banking team in Fearnley Securities. Fearnley Securities is the investment banking arm of the Astrup Fearnley Group, maybe for many of you more known as Fearnley's, which is the ship brokering entity. We have offices across, I think it's 10 countries in the world, and we're about 400 people. In Fearnley Securities, we do provide all investment banking services ranging from debt, equity, M&A, restructuring, and other sorts of advisory. And our core businesses are anything related to the maritime and energy industries. Deal sizes vary from, I don't know, $20 million to $1.5 billion and anywhere in between.
Berlin, over to you.
Right. Hi, everyone. My name is Berlin, although I'm from Shanghai. I'm the managing partner of HIT Marine, which is a shipbroking firm established in 2001. We've been quite active on ship finance side recently in the past couple of years, having arranged more than $1 billion sale-leaseback transactions for foreign ship owners with Chinese leasing houses. So I personally speak with about 30 leasing houses on a daily basis. So it's a full cover of all leasing houses which can provide ship finance US dollars. So I hope to be able to provide some useful information about the leasing market in China and add some colors to today's discussions. Thank you.
Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Christoph Benecke. I'm working for Mirbaum Capital Solutions. We are based in Germany, working as an advisory to a U.S. fund, which is Oaktree. And in addition to the advisory, we are then also structuring and managing the transaction, which are all on the basis of financial leasing. That's what we are doing.
Good afternoon. My name is Christian. A few people from you will know me. I've been on the banking side for close to 20 years. About 2 years ago, I joined Puros. Puros is a company focusing on transportation. Our main focus on gas and wind, but we also do own a few container vessels and a ferry system in Europe. Focuses on decarbonization, as long as commercially viable. And yeah, my responsibility with Impuros is to look after financing. So everything I've done previously on the banking side is now switched to the owner side. And I do talk to Chinese leasing as well, to our Japanese leasing, to banks, alternative capital providers. And maybe I can give a bit more of a holistic view of what is out there today and what's feasible or attractive.
Thanks, guys. So we'll go straight into the first theme, capital providers. And Berlin, this will be a question for you. You know, a key part of what you do is closing the gap between ship owners looking for debt and debt providers. The traditional European banks play a significant and enduring role in financing larger shipping companies, and there's a heavy emphasis on balance sheet and scale. Generally, there's been a kind of pronounced shift away from pure asset-backed financing models. The Chinese leasing companies and JOLCO providers have typically targeted a similar customer base to the European banks. But can you give us your insights into how this may be evolving in the context of what is a generally strong shipping market, touching on what you see in terms of a well-performing middle market and how they're obtaining debt finance? And I know you've got a strong expertise on the Chinese leasing side, so if you can weave that into the answer.
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Jeff. So I think the question is regarding how the lessors respond to the needs from the medium or medium-small-sized ship owners. So as Jeff said, right, so previously the Chinese lessors, you know, pretty much focused on big names, like, you know, like pretty much like Western banks. So they were focusing on big balance sheets, a strong counterpart. But I think over the past couple of years, we all realize the situation is quite different by now. Like the majority of the inquiry is coming from medium or even medium small size ship owners. So as a response to this sort of requirements, I think, you know, we've noticed some interesting changes or trends from Chinese lessors in response to the adapting to adapt to the needs of the of those clients. So first of all, it's something like, you know, we say in terms of the type of transactions. So we are seeing more and more non-recourse transactions now. So previously, like 2-3 years ago, right, in China, you probably only have like Mingxiong as the only one who could have done non-recourse. And they will be asking like, what, like 500 to 550 bips margins, similar to MM Bank or other, you know, debt funds. But now, you know, from the most recent deal we concluded, we managed to collect like close to 10 offers on non-recourse basis at very attractive margins. So I would say like 1/3 of the leasing house, or close to 10 of them now, can try or can even do non-recourse financing, which is quite favorable or friendly for medium or medium small size ship owners. And the second notable trend is the ticket size. So 3-4 years ago, if you approach some leasing houses in China, they would have told you, oh, you know, I wouldn't do anything less than $20 or even $30 million. Because I have limited manpower, I want to focus on bigger deals. Last year, we managed to conclude a deal for a local Singaporean owner with a leasing house for about $4 million ticket size. But nicely, we are having a follow-up deal now, so we are increasing the financing amount for the leasing house. But that was another example. The lessors in China also are waiting to cater to the demand from the clients and try smaller deals nowadays as well. I think, you know, going back to the first question about like non-recourse, right? I think that also goes with the maturity of the Chinese leasing. They are getting more and more familiar with the market, so they are happy to take more risks in terms of accepting less or like weaker counterpart. But they are purely going to focus on asset. So that's why I think, you know, for more liquid assets, for relatively younger tonnage, you will have some, you know, good solutions in China for non-recourse. And also ticket size is no longer a big issue. And some lessors can even do older tonnage, like over 20 years old as well, based on like scrap value finance. So these are all the new developments in China over the past 2-3 years, which never happened in the past. Thank you.
Thanks for that insight into the Chinese leasing market, Berlin. Christoph, if I kind of come over to you now to get your perspective, in terms of financing the kind of smaller to medium-sized ship owners, you know, what are the kind of reoccurring themes or challenges that you're seeing when structuring deals with your clients? And have you seen any, what are the kind of solutions that you've also seen when dealing with those challenges?
Thank you. Well, I mean, we, as I already mentioned, we are also focused on doing leasing. So to a certain extent, it's quite similar to what Berlin already told you. We are indeed focused on the smaller or medium-sized companies. And so this is the first distinctions for what we're doing from banks. I mean, we are doing, you can call it financial leasing. It's a kind of alternative lending embedded in leasing structures, whereby we are obviously not focused on the Chinese market. And so that is then a difference to what Berlin just told you. A further point for us, important to be mentioned, is that we are focusing on existing vessels, so we would not go for new buildings. And we are doing, well, you can call it still asset-based financing, if you like, but of course it's not purely asset-based. It has to be seen as a combination of the asset and our evaluation of the shipping company for which we are providing financial services and financing. So that's a combination. But for us, we are not focused on any kind of recourse financing. That is something which, to our mind, is more left with the major banks. But that's also then obviously for different clients. We see a certain advantage to focus on the leasing, as this is obviously not regulated in the same way as bank financing is regulated, and these days it's becoming even more complicated for the banks. So this is, from our point of view, an advantage for the model of financial leasing. And the second point which we see, which is quite important, as I said, we are focusing on these existing vessels. We are there to help our clients to be able to compete in the S&P market. And if they want to be in a position where they can compete with cash buyers, they need to be sure that they have a financing offer at hand. It means reliability is important, but also, and that's to my mind perhaps the most important point, is the speed. So we have to be able, and we are able, to provide offers very quickly. And I think that's a big important point if you're focusing on this market segment. So that's actually the recurring point, as you asked. All the clients we are focusing on are not flush with equity, so they need the support, and they need the support quickly to be able to go out in the S&P market, and that's where we are there. Thank you.
Thanks, Christoph. And now, I guess, throwing a question to you, Christian, at the end. So, yes, we've got a variety of finance, capital providers, finance providers, and we know about mortgage-backed lending. The panel here has talked about Chinese leasing and leasing more generally. From a ship owner treasury perspective, there'll obviously be certain fundamentals that you will look at in terms of pricing, LTV, workable covenants. But what are the other kind of key factors that you consider when you're structuring a financing arrangement? And further linked to this, are you seeing any consistent themes in terms of structuring from the different capital providers?
Yeah, I want to take a step back and just, I mean, I work for a shipping company, and I think if you look at transaction LTVs, pricing, I think profile, that's all super important. But what is ultimately the role for the treasurer or the CFO, to some extent, to enable to be competitive out there to service your clients, right? So in the forefront is, I mean, you have your people, which are very important, you have the shareholder, you have your operations, which have to be there. But ultimately, we are in a business which is highly capital intensive. And secondly, it on top of it is very competitive. So where financing comes in, I think ultimately it facilitates to be able to actually service your clients. And that means basically continue doing your business and having charters, long-term charters with those clients. So, and there are obviously pricing LTV profiles come in. But that's a very snapshot view, right? It's like, okay, I want to win this deal. I need to have a low LTV or a high LTV, low pricing, long profile. But when you want to build a sustainable business in such a world, I think you have to have, of course, your transaction focus, but at the same time, you have to have a holistic view of who is going to support you in the medium and long term. And I think the other parts which are highly important are, and that's in shipping more than in other industries to some extent, I can say, I looked at it from a banking side, is relationships. People have to understand your business and the management and what you're doing. And you have to build those relationships, and you have to continue nurturing those relationships. And the second one, and you might not do a deal today, but maybe in 1 or 2 years' time, you become a relationship. The other one, I think, what we have seen in the financial crisis, and we all have seen at Marine Monies or at Capital Link forums, the debt providers to the industry has shifted significantly. I do think we have a very strong support of a diversified base of lenders out there nowadays in different kind of forms. But ultimately, that's you need to be versatile and flexible. There is volatility in the regulations for the service providers. Some can lend today more than next year, but they're back in 2 years' time. So you need to be able to tap different kind of finance providers. So flexibility, diversification is very important while you keep those relationships. And then, I mean, holistically, that comes sometimes maybe at a cost, but you still have to do your transactions, right? You still have to service your clients. So when you ask me now, two things which are important is diversification and relationships, I think, on top. It's super important.
Thanks, Christian. Berlin, any additional insights from the discussions you have with your clients?
No, I totally agree as what Christian just said, right? It's a relationship business. So that's why, you know, when we're trying to arrange deals for foreign ship owners with Chinese leasing, we always found it a bit, you know, sometimes there are a lot of cultural gap to be bridged. In addition to, you know, to things like, you know, the products, you know, but if we compare the products of Chinese leasing with other leasing products or like other types of financing, we'll say there are definitely certain advantages. That's why Chinese leasing been there for the past 15 years and so active. For example, if we compare with a Western bank, Chinese leasing tend to offer slightly higher LTV. I would say slightly because now the asset value is on the high side, so Chinese are not offering crazy high LTVs anyway. So they'll be like 5 to 10% higher than conventional bank loans. But if we compare with other sources of financing like JOLCO structure, or like this, they'll be like more flexible. That's what Christian just mentioned as well. You need more flexibility when the Chinese lessors will give you earlier repayment options. And also the conclusion time will be much quicker as well. But if you compare with debt fund, Christoph is very familiar with, I would say obviously the benefit is with the margins. So the leasing, the lessors are a lot cheaper. And also when you have new buildings in China, I think it's an obvious solution when you go to Chinese leasing for financing, for construction financing. So those are all the advantages by talking to clients, also leasing. But it's a difficult market in general for the lessors over the past two, three years. But we can maybe examine that, discuss about that later.
Yeah. Thanks, Billy.
I'll just wedge in a small thing here. Christian used the word diversification a few times, and I totally agree with him. But I think one really important point, and I'm kind of wedging in a little sales pitch for people like Berlin myself, but if you look at how the financing market has developed in terms of what are the typical attributes of the different regions, so in the past you saw that, you know, Japan was mostly about JOLCOs and lease financing, at least for foreign borrowers. Europe was mostly about traditional bank lenders that did mortgage loans. All of this has been turned upside down. Today, we do just as much mortgage loans in Japan as we do leasing, maybe even more mortgage loans. In Europe and the U.S., there's now a myriad of different alternative lenders that are not banks but are doing, you know, all sorts of structures from pref to secure junior. I mean, it could be anywhere in the capital structure. And this just means that orientating yourself and mapping out what the optimal source of capital for your business is actually much harder today than it was 10 years ago, because there's such an abundance of different solutions out there. And I think that's one of the reasons why people like Berlin and our firm are active, because there's just such a big selection out there.
Thanks for that, Nicholas. Appreciate that.
If I just may add one aspect, I mean, as we have been talking about the small and medium ship owners, I think it's also important to understand that they, at least in the beginning, they might not have the access to the capital providers themselves. Means to ask directly for a bank loan might be difficult for the smaller companies. So from that point of view, I think it's also an important function which also we are providing, that we are acting, you could say, as a conduit. I mean, on the one side, we are bringing in the equity investor, but this is then combined with bank debt, which the small owner might not have access to by himself. That is then perhaps the second step if he's further developing its business. But in the first phase, this is, I would say, an important benefit which we can provide.
Thank you for that. And certainly in terms of what comes across our desk as a law firm, I kind of alluded to it at the beginning, it is a lot more nuanced now. We're dealing with debt equity hybrids, leasing products, JOLCOs, the full ambit, project financings for the more on the LNG side. So it's a definite trend over the last decade in terms of having a more nuanced approach to capital raising. Moving the discussion beyond capital providers and structures and products to interest rates and asset values, we're obviously operating in a high interest rate environment now, albeit that there's indications that that's going to be progressively come down. And we're also operating in an environment where ship owners are sitting on cash that they've built up through trading over the last few years. It's been a very positive place to be in shipping. So, Nicholas, with that in mind, what conversations are you having with clients in terms of debt and equity capital raising? And in the context of vessel acquisitions, sales, and taking into account the macroeconomics that we've touched upon, and can you kind of break that down into some digestible chunks for the audience?
Big ask, but I'll try. So first of all, I think there's been a general focus on deleveraging. I think partially that's because of where we are in terms of asset values. So people have been generating massive cash flow through a few years now of good markets, have been using a lot of that excess cash flow to deleverage. We also see that when they reinvest, we very rarely get inquiries for assisting with raising debt capital of more than 60%. Maybe if it's backed by like a 10-year contract to an investment-grade counterparty or something like that. But otherwise, usually people like to stay lower on LTV these days. And I don't think that's driven so much by interest rates because, like I said, the cash flows are there. You know, the freight markets in most segments are very strong, and so they can easily cover the interest rates of whether there are SOFRs at 5.3 or 3 or 7. I don't think that's the determining factor. There is an abundance of available capital out there. You know, the general sentiment around shipping is strong, maybe with the exception of a few segments. And so that means that there is an abundance of debt capital and equity capital available. Often we tell our clients, you know, take the money when it's there. But at the same time, you can't raise money without having use of proceeds. And I have to say that sometimes, you know, we have mixed feelings about saying take the money when it's there, given where we are in the cycle now, because even though it seems to have legs, we all have seen how high asset values are, new building prices, etc. And so unless there's material contract coverage or some special reason to invest, you know, there are small pockets of segments where there's a very positive outlook for the supply-demand balance. But unless that's the case, you know, there's no point in issuing a $500 million bond just because you can, if that means you need to buy or order ships at the top of the market or buy second-hand ships at the top of the market and have to take a big residual value risk. So I'm happy to say that our clients, for the most part, are taking quite a conservative stance and are keeping in mind the fact that, you know, you can't live with the cash break-evens that are implied by leverage of much higher than 60% if we go back to a normalized market. One last point is that we see a willingness to a larger extent amongst clients to raise external capital, maybe in private structures, maybe through the Norwegian project finance market, as a way to be able to grow without, you know, carrying the full burden themselves. And I think that's quite a positive thing. We're, you know, we like JVs, we've set up a lot of them, and we think that, I know we're getting into that a little bit later, but given the right attributes, we think that, that's a positive thing. And raising external capital doesn't only have to be in the public markets.
Thanks, Nicholas. And Christoph, are you seeing similar trends with your clients?
High interest rates or high base rates have been a problem, and still for some of them are a problem these days. I mean, this is something which is obviously something which not only we are seeing. This is a general thing. However, to my mind, this is not, let's say, the most decisive factor. There are other points, and that is more referring to the shipping markets or the market segments in the shipping business themselves, so whether it's based on high interest rates or not. But the question, what are the factors which are influencing the shipping markets? And there are quite some significant features, as we all know. I mean, whether it's geopolitics or new bank regulations, other regulations like climate change-related regulations, demand shifting, changes in trade patterns, all that is related to the shipping markets. And I think that is something which has an impact, which is a challenge. Means on the other side, business is still there. As I said, for some shipping companies, it might be more difficult if the interest rates keep on to be on the high side. But it's, at the end of the day, not the most decisive factor from our point of view. If you find a way to manage the other challenges which are out there. On the second point, on the high interest, on the high asset values, this is something where we are a bit more cautious. If we see a trend that asset values are going up too much, then we would rather refrain and would take a more wait-and-see position. On the other hand, we are very much able and willing to do investments on a sound cyclical basis, which might create good opportunities as well, if you are basically in a position to do that.
Thanks. And then, Christian, over to you. In terms of, you know, prior to your current role, you operated in a bank, and I'm sure clients were asking you for high LTVs for the longest period of time. Are you now, when you're talking to your bank group, comfortable with those lower LTVs?
It depends. I mean, I have a different hat now, but I want to take a step back, right, again. Is interest environments have come down, right? We're in a much better environment now than 1.5 years ago. I think there should always be a financial policy in place, and every ship owner, every shipping company will have a different business model to some extent. They have to adjust their financial policy towards it. But we are trying to manage those financial risk, right? And we are not waiting until last minute until interest rates level rise. But I think the main risk people always forget is, and we just go back into November 2022, when suddenly there was a liquidity squeeze in the market and people didn't know what does it mean. That's when interest rates, levels were rising. So when you then have a significant order book on finance at the point of time, that's a pretty uncomfortable position to be in. The thing is, interest rate levels really increase. When you have long-term charters locked in, you are basically diminishing your shareholder returns, potentially for the long term. The other reason is, when it's really a financial crisis coming, you might not find capital actually to finance your order book. I think that are the major risk out there. When it comes to interest rate risk management, you have to manage it. I mean, swap rates are now at probably 3.5%. It's not a crystal ball. You have to manage it. You have to sensitize it and see how much
comfortable with. I mean, no one knows what the future brings. Where are new interest levels going to be? Where is inflation going to be? I think we have all expectation, but we don't know. But I think the risk, the low probability, high impact risk is you have a huge order book unfinanced, and then things happening with liquidity squeeze, and then that's why you have to diversify. That's why you need to have your partnerships. That's why you have to manage your interest rate risk proactively. I mean, it's never perfect, but that's, I think, what we are trying to achieve.
Thanks, Christian.
And then, when the LTV supports it, then it's okay.
And then lastly, Berlin, over to you in terms of we discussed before the conference the interplay between what you described as low margins compared to high cost of finance. Can you just give some insight there?
Yeah, sure. It's really definitely a very challenging market for financiers. But as Nicholas mentioned, maybe it's a good market for arrangers because there are so many different options out there. So sometimes owners do need some guidance, you know, on what's the best option. Well, the high SOFR really increases the total cost. While owners assess their break-even, they will be based on 7-9% interest rate. That's even close to maybe long-term return for ship owners if you look at 10 to 15 years. So why borrowing more money rather than, you know, keep your, maybe use your own money unless you have to borrow the money? So that's why it's very challenging for financiers, especially for lessors, right? Chinese lessors, they used to be really good at, you know, providing slightly higher LTV and trying to get a clients. Like a year ago, right, this time last year, talking about the margins, if the margin around mid-high 200 bps, there will be a quite okay margin level, I think. But just over the 12 months, I think there's sort of like a collapse of the margin rate. Now mid-high 200 is already on the high side for a lot of cases. But I think this is more like a dynamic balance we're looking for. This is like it's a cyclical business as everything, like as the freight market, as the new building market, as new building price, the freight rate. Now it's definitely like the low side for the margins. But, you know, with if the situation continues, a lot of financiers will say, you know, okay, it's a risky business. I'd rather not to lend money at such a low level. With the same case with Chinese lessors. They thought this is a profitable business, but when they realize this is risky business but not that profitable, you know, they'll try to diversify into more other business. So I think we are more looking for a like dynamic balance in the next couple of years. I think the margin will eventually go back to a more healthy level. So this level is probably not going to be sustainable. For a lot of lessors, they are quoting like 150 to 300 levels at the moment in China. So I wouldn't say it's a sustainable level, you know, going forward.
Thanks for that. Just moving on to the next trend or theme of the discussion, vessel life optimization and retrofits. We're going to look at the availability of finance and some of the kind of practical and legal challenges. Maybe we can touch upon green loans, sustainability-linked loans, new builds and versus retrofits, and potentially energy security, albeit that was touched on during an earlier panel. So, Christian, over to you in terms of the first question here. Prus has obviously drawn significant attention in terms of what it's doing in this space. How is the wider strategic company focus manifesting itself in terms of your borrowing strategies when looking at vessel life optimization and retrofits, but obviously taking into account that your fleet is generally a newer fleet, so retrofits may be less of a concern?
Yeah, maybe to reiterate, we largely focus on gas and wind. So asset class you would see is LNG, medium-sized gas carriers, VLECs, CSOVs, SOVs, CTVs. We do have a little bit of infrastructure and ferries and containers, but focus really on gas and wind. I would say, I mean, and I mentioned it in the first question, is ultimately we have a business strategy, and the business strategy is to focus on gas and wind, and the business strategy is to service our clients to enable the energy transition, and ultimately to decarbonize our assets. I think that's a fundamental strategy which is there. The financial strategy, we follow this business strategy, we have to support it. And we have to find all means to see, is there potentially financing available to make it more efficient for us? Does the financial strategy dictate the business strategy? I don't think so. So that's to be pretty clear. Having said so, I think there are buckets out there or capital providers which are focusing on energy transition, probably also on retrofitting, and where your business profile fits very well into their strategy and which will help you to support your business focus. And I will be very honest, have I seen significant amount of capital being provided? I don't think so as well. I think it is more, and I have to be careful, but it's quite a regulatory approach also going forward at the moment, that there will be capital available for certain business profiles and asset classes, and less capital available for other business profiles and other asset classes. I don't see the incentivized approach of incentivizing, we talk about ESG, but truly incentivizing energy transition. I think it's more a capital allocation approach, which you see in the market at the moment. So that's my take. But obviously my role with Impuros is to talk to our providers, to look at what financing sources are available, and our partners are looking at the same and having the dialogue and trying to see that the capital and the support is there from our partners for our business model.
Yeah.
Does that answer your question?
That definitely touches upon most of it. One more question, unscripted, for you. We were speaking about a recent new build of yours where you've put in the carbon capture technology. From a financing perspective, how did you make that work? Obviously, there'll be an additional capital outlay for that technology.
Yeah, I think, again, it's driven by the business, right? In this sense, we have our partner here as well. Nordic, it was in the press. I mean, it is driven by the demand of the charterers in this regard and the trading patterns of the vessel. That's why it's makes it work, right, ultimately. How you optimize your financing structure, I think, is a secondary question to it afterwards. Do we have separate financing for it? Not yet. Can we think about it potentially? Yeah. But it is not driven by financing.
Thank you. Just conscious of time, I'm going to skip a couple of questions so we can get to the last subject. Nicholas, one for you. Vessel life optimization retrofits, how do you see these or related issues playing out in terms of how you help your clients? And are you seeing increased activities or awareness linked to targeted decarbonization investments?
Well, I have to say that I'm not a huge believer in the incentives in place today in terms of green-linked financing products, simply because I think that the discounts that are given, even if you hit all your KPIs, are fairly negligible in the greater scheme of things. But I do think that there is a pretty strong push, and we see that from our clients, in decarbonizing in shipping. I don't think it would make sense for everyone to go out and try to sort of replace current fleets with new buildings, because I don't think that's environmentally sensible. But I do think that one should make the most out of the modern fleet that's on the water today, and that in combination with the gradual decarbonization is kind of the route that we see our clients taking. But I'm very happy to see that there's been a shift over the last couple of years where a lot of our clients were just saying, no, we're just going to go new buildings on everything and order dual fuel, to now being more, no, hold on, we're only going to do that against long-term charters, and we'd rather retrofit our existing vessels. You know, there's no reason why a 10-year-old tanker, which is eco, should be scrapped earlier than 25 years, when you can retrofit ducts and use silicon paints and other things that would improve the or lower the environmental footprint and improve the performance of the vessel. So I think that's kind of what we're seeing from our clients.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting. I mean, as a shipping company, there's a tendency to focus on scope one, scope two, but if we're looking at the full life cycle of the asset, scope three is obviously critical and becoming much more part of the conversation in terms of decarbonisation. So anyone with an existing fleet with legacy needs to look at the retrofit optionality. We're coming up to the end of our time. Is there any additional comments just on the decarb?
One more comment on that. I think, again, at this point of decarbonization strategies, you have to differentiate or to see the difference between the new building market and the market for existing vessels. And then, secondly, the combination of existing vessels and small and medium owners, which to my mind are not really the group which can be first mover with regard to pulling out money to do retrofits. I mean, this may happen sometimes if it comes along with financing the vessel. But basically, this is something which has to be initiated by others. And secondly, just to mention another point, you have to bear in mind the time horizon. I mean, if we are doing, let's say, a maximum leasing term of 5 years, then both sides, means that we as a financing provider and also the shipping company, have to check, is that the time horizon where it makes sense to add to the pure vessel financing also a retrofit financing or not?
Thanks, Christoph. Perfect. We had one more subject, so feel free to ask each of the panel members during the coffee break about JVs, strategic acquisitions, and M&A activity. But otherwise, thank you very much. Thank you.